This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 13, 2008. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Senate debates the definitions of torture and waterboarding. Activists protest Mexican President Felipe Calderón's visit to California. And pro-war protesters try to pressure the city of Berkeley to back down from its stance against military recruiting. Those stories and more, but first, the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The government of Australia today issued a historic apology to Aborigines. The newly inaugurated Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, had promised to make the apology a priority upon taking office. The apology specifically addressed a decades-long policy that forcibly removed Aboriginal children from their families to be raised in white households. Some members of the so-called Stolen Generations are demanding reparations, but legal experts say today's apology bears no weight in pending court cases for compensatory damages. As the European Union tries to combat the latest U.S. government demands for data on U.S.-bound air passengers, the EU has its own plans for compulsory fingerprinting and monitoring of all visitors crossing its borders. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Department of Homeland Security spokesman Russ Knox says the US applauds the European Commission's plans for the compulsory fingerprinting of all visitors to the EU, as well as automated border checks of EU nationals through fingerprints and facial scan analysis. Personal data could be kept for up to 13 years. Over 300 million travellers cross EU external borders every year. But the main targets of these measures are refugees, increasingly forced to access Europe illegally. Gemma Jimmer of the Refugee Council.
We've seen that as border controls are strengthened, the problem doesn't go away. The issue is just displaced and people take ever more dangerous routes because there are no legal avenues for them to reach the EU.
If all EU member states back the plan, an electronic registration system could be launched by 2015. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A top Hezbollah commander was killed in the Syrian capital last night. Hezbollah blames Israel for the car bomb assassination, an accusation the Israeli government denies. Imad Mournia was wanted by Israel, the U.S., and Argentina. He is thought to have plotted a number of high-profile attacks, including the 1983 bombings of the U.S. Embassy and Marine Barracks in Beirut, the 1985 hijacking of a TWA flight, and the 1994 bombing of a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. Hezbollah is a powerful opposition party in Lebanon, but considered a terrorist organization by the governments of Israel and the United States. In other news from the Middle East, the Israeli army abducted dozens of Palestinian civilians during a pre-dawn invasion of three West Bank towns and cities today. Hassan Banour reports from Bethlehem.
The Israeli military operation targeted the village of Beit Umar near Hebron, the Al-Khadr village near Bethlehem, and the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The majority of the abducted civilians are from Beit Umar. Israeli troops stormed the village at around 1 a.m., placing the village under curfew and raiding scores of homes. Israeli soldiers kidnapped 55 local residents. All are men between the ages of 18 and 45. A group of international human rights workers from the Christian Peacemaker Teams, CBT, entered Beit Umar for several hours this morning before the army forced them out. CBT worker Tariq Abu Atta witnessed the operation.
55 arrests so far, as well as the ongoing house-to-house searches. They were going in, staying for about 15 minutes, and what they were looking at is they asked for everybody's ID in the house. They saw the layout of the house. They took a phone number. They were collecting some statistics. House by house.
The Israeli army left Nablus and Al-Khadr this morning, but soldiers remained in Beit Umar, declaring the town a closed military zone. For FSRN, this is Ghassan Bannoura in Bethlehem.
With parliamentary elections less than a week away, tens of thousands of Pakistani troops have been mobilized to protect some of the 64,000 polling stations across the country. Zach Badoff reports from Peshawar, Pakistan.
President Pervez Musharraf's government has pledged fair, transparent, and peaceful elections on Monday. More than 1,000 international observers and journalists and 20,000 local observers will be on hand to monitor the process. But Human Rights Watch said Tuesday the election cannot be considered impartial because of lack of action by the country's election commission on alleged campaign violations. Still, the Musharraf government is already preparing for its projected loss of power. The country's army chief is removing more than 300 military officers from civilian government posts. Meanwhile, the two political parties expected to gain the most seats in parliament declared today they'll work together. The widower of Benazir Bhutto met with Nawaz Sharif, a leading opposition candidate, Tuesday to start a partnership for the new government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Peshawar, Pakistan.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Barack Obama swept another three Democratic primaries with decisive victories in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Hillary Clinton is downplaying her losses by saying she's focusing on delegate-rich Texas. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more on the Democratic race, as well as the Green Party nomination.
It was another big day for Barack Obama. He is now ahead in the delegate count, despite Clinton's commanding lead in superdelegates. Obama has now won eight states in a row. His decisive wins in the Potomac region came with record-high Democratic primary turnout. Obtaining over 60% of the vote in Maryland and Virginia and three-quarters of the vote in the District of Columbia, Obama builds upon a wide-reaching coalition. Here he's speaking in Wisconsin Tuesday night.
We won the state of Maryland. We won the Commonwealth of Virginia. And though we won in Washington, D.C., this movement won't stop until there's change in Washington, D.C. And tonight we're on our way.
Clinton headed southwest to Texas, where she'll spend coming days and many of her resources to capture a majority of the 228 delegates at stake. In El Paso, she did not mention her losses. She stayed on message.
A lot of really hardworking folks are concerned. You know, they're working as hard as they can, but they don't feel like they're getting ahead.
While Clinton has moved on to Texas and later Ohio, states that vote March 4th, Obama is looking at the next primaries, Wisconsin and his home state of Hawaii. He introduced Wisconsin voters to his economic plan after touring a General Motors assembly plant there. As he did in South Carolina, he will likely connect Hillary Clinton to her husband's implementation of NAFTA, a trade agreement that's believed to be the cause of major job loss in the U.S. Meanwhile, Clinton released a new advertisement in Wisconsin challenging Obama to a debate there.
Hillary Clinton has said yes. Barack Obama hasn't. Maybe he'd prefer to give speeches than have to answer questions.
In other primary results from Tuesday, John McCain has proceeded along his path to the Republican nomination. He, too, swept the Potomac primary. And in the Green Party, former U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney easily won the Washington, D.C. race. And a local Maryland race drew attention. Progressive-backed candidate Donna Edwards beat eight-term Democratic incumbent Albert Wynn in that district's primary. Edwards gained the support of national progressive groups, she campaigned on a platform of change, and tied Wynn to the corporate Washington Democratic establishment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The U.S.'s policy on torture and waterboarding dominated debate in the Senate ahead of a vote on the intelligence authorization bill today. It contains a provision that would extend the Army Field Manual on Interrogation Tactics, which outlaws specific torture techniques, including waterboarding, to all government agencies, including the CIA. Intelligence Committee member Orrin Hatch opposes CIA compliance. He says the Army Field Manual is intended for the lowest-ranked service member, not the highly trained CIA officer.
But the conflict over what was lawful in interpretation in the first 2 years after the 9/11 attacks recognizes, to the honest analyst, that there is murkiness in the intersection of law, policy, and legal interpretation. That has always been the case. And as I say, I do not want to inhibit this debate. I also do not want to wish that historic debate to inhibit any techniques we need to use for interrogation today.
The U.S.'s definition of torture has become one of the most heated debates in Washington 80 years after the Geneva Conventions sought to outlaw torture internationally.
Recent admissions by Intelligence Director Michael Hayden that waterboarding was applied to three subjects, Attorney General Michael Mukasey's failure to define waterboarding as torture, and the White House's attempt to frame waterboarding as acceptable in some situations, has caused outrage among human rights advocates and some members of Congress. Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts.
The White House position is directly contrary to the findings of courts, military tribunals, and legal experts that waterboarding is a violation of U.S. law and a crime against humanity. In the words of a former master instructor for U.S. Navy SEALs, waterboarding is slow-motion suffocation with enough time to contemplate the inevitability of blackout and expiration. Usually the person goes into hysterics on the board. With the uninitiated, it is horrifying to watch, and if it goes wrong, it can lead straight to terminal hypoxia.
The city of Berkeley, California, hosted a large and confrontational street protest yesterday, sparked by the city's official stance over a marine recruitment office. Berkeley drew the ire of Republican lawmakers, the right-wing media, and pro-war groups after it voted 2 weeks ago to tell the Marines that they were unwelcome intruders if they chose to keep their offices open in downtown Berkeley. Hundreds of Iraq War supporters spent the day in Berkeley hoping to pressure the city council and the mayor to back down and apologize, but they were met in equal numbers by supporters of the city's stand against the war. FSRN's Eric Klein has more.
The sun rose and set in Berkeley yesterday, with protesters facing off on the street in front of City Hall. The evening culminated with individuals given 1 minute apiece to share their opinions with the council and the viewing public, a stream of voices that lasted for over 3 hours. Debbie Lee is the mother of Mark Allen Lee, the first Navy SEAL killed in Iraq.
I'm appalled at what the city council has done and how they told our Marines, for years we've heard from you, that they're not welcome, they don't belong in Iraq, and now you're telling our troops they don't belong in America? That's appalling.
2 weeks ago, the Berkeley City Council voted to oppose the local Marine recruitment station by sending a letter to the Marines requesting they leave town and supporting any nonviolent action that impeded the work of recruiters. The move touched off a national outcry from war supporters. Again, Gold Star mother Debbie Lee.
We're demanding that you issue an apology, not only to the Marines here, but to all of our troops who have served, to the military families. You have offended us deeply.
But the city council was one vote short from submitting an official apology, and instead tweaked the language of the original item to soften the unwelcome message. Many Berkeley residents in attendance were in strong support of the council's stance. Jeff Patterson is a former Marine who works on anti-recruitment campaigns.
I'm here mainly to express my gratitude for the council's actions in support of a truly grassroots community effort to counter military recruiting in our community, a grassroots effort that's going up against $6 billion of federal government money to convince our kids to join the military.
Berkeley's Brian Lee attended a recent Marine recruitment event with a friend. He said that it felt like he was being brainwashed and lied to.
My friend joined. I went with him to support him, and I do support him, but I do not support the Marines. I do not support this war, and I do not support them being in Berkeley.
Dale Adams was one of the out-of-town critics of Berkeley's stand against the military.
I drove 18 hours to get here from Colorado.
Adams, a Vietnam veteran, accused the people of Berkeley of being on the wrong side of history.
The community around here treated us pretty shabbily. You remember it, and a lot of you other people were on the wrong side, that you painted all the Vietnam veterans as baby killers and everything. My son is now in the Army, and it's not going to happen anymore.
Adams was particularly critical of Berkeley councilperson Max Anderson, a fellow veteran of the war in Vietnam and an ex-Marine.
You're on the internet as one of the worst ones up there, and I am ashamed of you.
Councilperson Anderson responded later.
I don't think we owe anyone an apology. I think that we spoke truth to power, and power reacted.
Berkeley has been threatened by Republicans in the U.S. Senate, as well as the State Assembly, with a loss of federal dollars in retaliation, a threat which is considered largely symbolic. Council members say they have also received over 20,000 emails and phone messages in recent days, most of them condemning the action, but Councilperson Anderson called the deluge the result of a hateful, right-wing media campaign, based on an exaggerated vision of the city's actual power over the future of the recruitment center, as well as intentionally confusing the city's real anti-recruiting efforts with a non-existent insult to the troops. Anderson said that the Iraq War, based on lies and fabrications, was itself to blame.
If anybody owes any apologies, it's that Bush regime that led us down this path and sacrificed these lives of people, both in Iraq and in the people of this country.
Claire Greensfelder was one of the last members of the public to speak. It was well after midnight when she tried to put the previous day's events into perspective.
I applaud the City Council for one of the unintended consequences of this particular event is that it has brought forward a national dialogue here on television for everyone to hear. And you can see the pent-up frustrations of our entire country with this war. My feeling is this, that the same way that Berkeley has come forward to reconsider some of its acts and also improve upon its language, if only our president and government had taken the same opportunity to reconsider the war and the mistakes that they made, we would all be in a better place today and probably not be here tonight.
From Berkeley, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Mexican President Felipe Calderon is in California today on his first trip to the United States since taking office in a highly contested election less than 2 years ago. Calderon is aiming to add his voice to the immigration debate, even urging presidential candidates to resist the urge to scapegoat immigrants. He's addressing California's lawmakers today and meeting privately with Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in Sacramento before heading to Los Angeles, where he's scheduled to meet with Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. Calderon's visit has sparked protests throughout the political range, including those who say that his support of trade agreements like NAFTA has forced people to leave their homes in Mexico to find work in the U.S. Some 50 people are gathered outside the California Capitol today, where they're protesting Calderon's visit. One of them is youth community activist Randy Lopez. How are you today, Randy?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. Now, you're a high school student. Why did you feel that it was necessary to not go to school today to participate in this protest?
Well, I mean, first step to, you know, immigration reform and to simply solve the immigration problem, NAFTA is responsible for it. And hearing about a week ago that he was coming to Sacramento trying to talk about immigration, I just felt that how can this guy come here and try to talk about immigration when he hasn't done anything back home? So that just sparked it that, you know, that's not right. Why is he going to come here and, you know, on his first trip to the United States and try to talk about this when he hasn't done anything about it? He should be doing his work back home. And once he does that, come out here to demand equality within all immigrants. So that just made me, you know, organize, come and become active with it, and organize, you know, my students, my peers back at school. For anything to happen, we got to come out here and, you know, demand and let him see that we want him to do the right thing and not just not do anything at all, but come in here and try to spark a debate with immigration reform.
And Felipe Calderon is very used to protests back home. They started before he was even elected into office. Do you think that he's hearing these protests? Do you think they're having any effect on him and his policies?
Well, of course, you know, we all know he stole the election, and I'm pretty sure he knows we're here. I mean, we weren't in front of the Capitol when he was here screaming and chanting, even after getting harassed by the police, trying to take our mics away. He knew our presence was there. There's no way that, you know, he can just walk in there and be all happy meeting the governor without hearing his own people standing up against him. It's just going to spark some debate, you know, hearing that people aren't completely with them. And he's hearing the message. I'm pretty sure politicians inside during his tour, they brought him around windows so they can see us outside. And he has a sense that people are against him and are even here demanding he does something about the people back in Mexico.
Randy Lopez is a youth community activist. He joined us from Sacramento, where he's protesting Mexican President Felipe Calderon's visit. The the streets of most major Grecian cities rumbled as 200,000 workers, farmers, and students answered the call for a second general strike in as many months. At issue is the conservative government's plan to reform the Greek Social Security and Pensions Program. FSRN's Aris Okinomo reports from Athens.
The reforms in question include the increase of the retirement age from 60 to 65 years and up to 67 years or even 70 years on a voluntary basis, an increase in the number of years one must work to have the right to retire, the increase of workers' economic contribution to their pension funds, and finally, a decrease in the amount some groups of workers will receive. Alexandros Koufas, student in Law School of Athens, was in the streets today.
We are fed up. Salaries are really low. Working conditions are getting harder and harder. And now the government wants to pass this reform, which is clearly against the students and future workers. The EU-guided reforms will simply further degrade our living standards. We are already the generation of 700 euros. If this reform passes, we will become the generation of 300 euros when we retire.
According to Eurostat, in Greece, the average salary is around 700 euros per month, and the average retirement received is around 400 to 600 euros per month. Even after EU enlargement, Greece is one of the countries with the lowest incomes in the EU. Workers and farmers' unions see the conservative Nea Dimokratia party propositions to reform the social security and pension system as yet another erosion of their quality of life. Yanis Georgiadis is a construction worker and a representative of All Workers Combative Front, PAME.
The plan of the government is obvious. They want to make us work longer and get paid less. I've worked for 30 years in construction, and I was supposed to retire next year. But if the new law passes, I will have to work for another 5 and receive a smaller amount. This will not pass. Today we are thousands in the streets. Next time we will be even more.
The government, since its re-election in September 2007, has said that these reform measures are the only solution to solve the economic and demographic pressures on the state funds that will pay for retirement in the future. Yorgos Alogoskoufis, the Minister of the Economy, states,
"The population is living longer. If they do not work more, who is going to pay for future retirement?"
But some, like Aleka Papagiorga, member of the General Confederation of Greek Workers, says that government is going back on its word.
"We do not believe the government in its intentions. Before the elections took place in 2007, it promised that it would not touch the system of social protection. Now it is proposing to increase the retirement age and decrease the amount of money that will be received after 35 and 40 years of work."
Social security and retirement has been a contentious issue in Greece for the past 20 years. Every government, be it the PASOK, Socialist Party that was in office for 20 years, or the Nea Dimokratia, have tried to implement reforms. In the past, there have been two important attempts, and both were crushed by popular discontent. Although the workers' response has been robust, the government has not yet taken a position on the strikes. After the last general strike in December, the government fired the minister in charge of social affairs and replaced him with a new minister known for his moderate positions. For FSRN, this is Aris Economou from Athens.
In the last 3 years, Peru has sold off more than 50% of its Amazon region, with little fanfare from the international community. Yet locally, a growing movement of indigenous people, together with environmental activists, continue to organize and fight for their culture and their land. People on both sides of the issue met up in Houston last week. FSRN's Rachel Clark was at the Houston Petroleum Club, where one man pled the case for the indigenous people he represents.
Yo estoy aquí solo, pero allá mis pueblos son muchos.
Here I'm today alone, but in Peru, my people are many.
Robert Guimaraes Vasquez made this declaration in front of the Houston Petroleum Club last week. As the vice president of the Interethnic Development Association of Peru, Guimaraes makes this pilgrimage annually with a very clear message.
Desde aquí quiero denunciar al Estado peruano por la vulneración de nuestros derechos.
From here, I want to denounce the Peruvian government for having disrespected our rights as indigenous people.
Since 2003, the Peruvian government has bit by bit sold off blocks of the Amazon rainforest to North American corporations such as Hunt Oil and Chevron Texaco. Indigenous residents, human rights advocates, and environmentalists say the most recent blocks sold both last year and scheduled for sale this year encroach on lands of the most vulnerable inhabitants of the region, who live in voluntary isolation. Despite mounting opposition, Peru Petro President Daniel Saba claims allegations of encroachment and community endangerment are simply the opinions of a few with no basis in fact.
I am telling you that this information is the opinion of only one person and is an opinion full of mistakes and faulty interpretations. It is based on the studies of one anthropologist who, under supposed optimum conditions, discovered there are many people living in voluntary isolation. And this is rather odd, because if you discover people living in isolation, then they aren't truly living in isolation. How would you have discovered them?
Not so, says environmental lawyer Carlos Sorias.
In the case of oil block 107, the Cacataibo isolated indigenous people live. This week, there was an encounter of the oil workers with the Cacataibo isolated indigenous people. They stayed in the settlement that they found with small leaf huts, and the Cacataibos returned to the area and painted blood on the trees as a clear sign that they want them out of their land.
Sorias's organization, the Institute of Communal Property, together with the Federation of Indigenous Cacataiwai Communities and the Center for Environmental Law, filed a suit in December with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
To order the Peruvian government to stop oil drilling in the areas occupied by the Cacataiwai isolated peoples.
The commission has yet to rule. In the meantime, Sylvia Sibarowski, a former Fulbright scholar who lived and worked near the Corrientes River of northern Peru, says that the situation has been complicated by a divide-and-conquer strategy.
And there were so many cases where the oil company offered benefits in order to put in oil wells. For example, in one community, the company gave them about $10,000 to the community, and in exchange, the oil company got to put in two new wells. But they only talked to one community, but there are so many other communities that were not consulted. So this not only is buying off, but creating division. I just think that a lot of investors that go into the region do not understand the situation with indigenous groups. The company will always bring in an indigenous person that represents their interests.
It is this battle against misinformation that Robert Guimaraes Vasquez is fighting both at home and abroad. In the face of a looming legal battle and with more of his homeland being sold off, Guimaraes and the thousands he represents are unwavering in their resolve.
Vamos a ser más enérgicos para defender nuestros territorios, si fuera posible, con nuestras propias vidas.
We're going to have more energy to defend our lives and our lands. If it comes to this, we'll put our lives on the line.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.